Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and today we're going to do chapter 24, The Second Vatican Council Begins, of E. Michael Jones's The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And there are just a few main sources of this, another one of these shorter chapters. Let's look at the back and see chapter 24. Viscount Leon Poncins, Poncins, Judaism in the Vatican, An Attempt at a Spiritual Subversion. It's from 1967. Robert Blair Kaiser, Clerical Error, A True Story. It's from 2002. Preparatory Report, Second Vatican Council, 1965. And E. Michael Jones himself, John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution, I guess from his magazine. Finally, Michael Serafi and the Pilgrim, Farrar, Straus & Company, 1964. All right, going to the text itself. The Second Vatican Council begins. In 1960, shortly before Bobby Dylan arrived in New York City, a French Jew by the name of Jules Isaac went to Rome to discuss what he saw as the Catholic Church's 2,000-year-old teaching of contempt against his people. Isaac was the former Inspector General of France's public schools and a historian who had written two books on Catholic attitudes toward the Jews after losing a number of family members during the war. In Jesus et Israel, 1946, Jesus and Israel, and Genesis of Antisemitism, in French, in 1948, Isaac made two points that would dominate Catholic-Jewish dialogue for the rest of the century. Isaac claimed the Catholic Church had preached anti-Semitism for 2,000 years, which, too, found its ultimate expression in the mass murder of Jews during World War II. Father Paul DeMann from Paris and Father Gregory Bowne, a Jewish convert from Canada, spread his thesis in Catholic circles. Bowne called Jesus in Israel a moving account of the love which Jesus had for his people, the Jews, and of the contempt which the Christians later harbored for them. In 1947, Isaac participated in a conference in Salzburg, Switzerland, that issued a memo on, quote, the rectification of Christian teaching concerning Israel. In 1949, Isaac met with Pope Pius XII. Isaac wanted the Pope to write an encyclical condemning anti-Semitism, but nothing came of the meeting. It's not difficult to understand why. Despite the openly pagan ideology of National Socialism and the havoc it wrought, Isaac felt the most dangerous form of anti-Semitism was the oxymoron known as Christian anti-Semitism. An alt way of looking at it might be with the more dangerous force cleared up, they turned to the lesser problem that they'd somehow been able to live with for 2,000 years that wasn't trying to wipe them out the way the NS was, or at least get them wiped out of Europe to their own country. Because it was theological and not racial, it perdured much longer than Hitler's racial views. Not correct. It was around longer, but Hitler's racial views are still out there, and they haven't died down at all. They've gotten sharper and sharper, deeper and deeper. Its roots went back to Christianity's fundamental text, in particular the Gospels of Matthew and John and the writings of the Church Fathers, St. John Chrysostom, St. Ambrose, St. Augustine, and Pope St. Gregory the Great. When Isaac arrived at the Vatican in 1960 for his second visit, the times had changed dramatically since 1949. The genial Giuseppe Roncalli had succeeded the austere Eugenio Pacelli, but the changed atmosphere was traceable to more than just a difference of personality. Roncalli had lived through the war, but Pacelli had been nuncio to Germany during the rise of National Socialism. He had been in Munich during the First and Second Bavarian Soviet Republics, so he'd seen what happened when Jews were in charge. Jewish communists in particular. He had seen the Levine administration and their slutty hangers-on when he visited the Wittelsbach Palace in 1919, and he knew the rise of Hitler in Bavaria in 1923 was predicated on the excesses of Jewish Bolshevism there and not on readings of the sermons of St. John Chrysostom or the Gospel of St. John. Flipping on to 884. Pacelli had emerged from World War II as a hero, a status the world's Jews confirmed at his death in 1958. But now a new spirit was blowing through the Vatican, and Isaac saw a window of opportunity for his ideas. Aside from its position in communist countries, The Catholic Church was an object of universal esteem in 1960, and it wanted to use that esteem to promote unity among Christians and reconciliation with the Jews. The Vatican Secretariat for Promoting Christian Unity had been set up months before Isaac's visit under the leadership of Augustine Cardinal Bea. Bea had known Jews from his days as a student and teacher in Berlin. From the Jewish perspective, the time was ripe to press for a condemnation of all it disliked about Catholic teaching on Jews. The French embassy, knowing the people behind Isaac, arranged a meeting with Cardinal Tisserand, who gave Isaac the runaround. Isaac wanted to meet with Pope John XXIII, but he was sent instead to the prefect of the Holy Office, Alfredo Cardinal Ottaviani, who then sent him to 83-year-old Andrea Cardinal Julian, hoping that a meeting between two old men, both hard of hearing, would lead nowhere. Ottaviani was wrong. After pleading his case, Isaac sat in silence, waiting. Julian finally said the word that provided the key for the door Isaac wanted unlocked. Bea. Augustine Cardinal Bea, the German Jesuit and biblical scholar who had authored Pius XII's encyclical on biblical scholarship, Divini Afflante Spiritu. On June 13, 1960, Isaac got his meeting with Pope John XXIII. The only account comes from Isaac, who introduced himself to the Pope as a non-Christian, the promoter of L'Amitié Judéo-Chrétienne, that's French Judeo-Christian, and a very deaf old man. The Pope took the initiative by discoursing on his devotion to the Old Testament. Sensing an opening, Isaac told the Pope, "This kindled great hopes in the people of the Old Testament. It was time to fulfill those expectations by issuing a condemnation of anti-Semitism." Pope John had been thinking along those lines, but he could not do this unilaterally because the Church was not a monarchie absolute, an absolute monarchy. Not long thereafter, Isaac learned with joy that the Pope had conveyed his suggestions to Cardinal Bea, who had been commissioned to work toward a firm condemnation of Catholic anti-Semitism. Bea would draft a text about Jewish-Christian relationships for the Council's consideration. Thus was born what came to be known as the Jewish Declaration. Imagine a Christian going to them and saying, I really want you to apologize for killing Christ. You know, this is how absurd this is. Whether you believe any of that stuff actually happened, I don't believe it did. The Pope's desire was transformed into something radically different when it made contact with the realities of 20th century Jewish interest groups and publicity organs. Before long, the peoples of the Old Testament, as they're calling themselves, falsely, were represented by international Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League. Rather than formulating the Catholic position on the Jews in light of Catholic tradition, Cardinal Bea, became a go-between between the Jewish organizations and the Council Fathers, who initially were also under the impression they were dealing with the people of the Old Testament. Because the Council Fathers were favorably impressed by Jules Isaac's petition, as opposed to his books, which they had not read, Isaac was allowed to determine the terms of the debate, becoming the principal theorist for the Vatican statement on the Jews. Isaac's friend, Bishop Provencheres, tried to spin this positively by claiming it was the first time a layman and a Jew had initiated a council document without bringing up the nagging question of who benefited from this break with tradition. Viscount Léon de Poncins was less reticent, claiming Isaac was the principal theorist and promoter of the campaign being waged against the traditional teaching of the Church. Nostra Aetate was destined to become a weapon designed to overthrow traditional Catholicism, which they consider the chief enemy. Such thoughts were far from the minds of the participants in the early dialogue between Catholics and Jews. The goal of contemning anti-Semitism seemed noble enough, but the spirit of the times precluded close theological examination of the terms of the discussion. Just who was going to determine the precise meaning of anti-Semitism? Popularized in Germany in 1870 by the racial thinker Wilhelm Marr, the word had a racial meaning. This was not problematic for German racists, but it was problematic for the Catholic Church, especially if she were to incorporate uncritically an essentially atheological and ideologically racial term into a conciliar document, that is, a document from a council. It would contradict a crucial assertion of the Catholic faith, the age-old admonition sicut iudaeus non, Jewish converts were to be accepted without prejudice. Quote unquote. If Jewish identity was based on race or blood or DNA and not on rejection of Christ, then baptism lost its efficacy. Key to understand this concept. By the time Jules Isaac finally got his meeting with the Pope in June 1960, Alfredo Cardinal Ottaviani had already commissioned the preliminary documents for the Second Vatican Council. The conventional explanation of the council is summarized in one word, aggiornamento, which was taken to mean bringing the church up to date. From Ottaviani's point of view, the church referred to the Curia, which had reached a state of near paralysis during the last days of Pius XII, and was seen as inadequate to the challenges facing it. In the hands of the revisionist, aggiornamento has taken on another meaning, namely getting the church to accept the tenets of the Enlightenment. Pius the Ninth condemned in his Syllabus of Errors. According to this view, aggiornamento meant reversing the craziness that had compelled Pope Pius IX to produce his famous Syllabus of Errors, which condemned a number of almost self-evident propositions, including this one. Quote, the Pope can and must try to achieve a reconciliation and a settlement with progress, liberalism, and modern civilization. From an American point of view, the term meant support for the theories of John Curry Courtney Murray, who wanted to baptize America's religious freedom and make it a part of Pope John's aggiornamento. According to the Americanist reading, there was rumor that Giuseppe Roncalli, Pope John XXIII, had been a covert sympathizer with the modernists. Ottaviani's involvement in the preparatory stages of the council tells another story, supported by a close reading of the preliminary documents. Judging from them, the point of the council was not to baptize the Enlightenment, but to reform the Curia, or the Curia, C-U-R-I-A, capital C, and make Catholics aware of a threat to faith and morals coming from the West, in particular the United States, and more particularly from Hollywood. In January 1962, the preparatory document on the moral order, quote-unquote, was submitted to the council for deliberation. In it, Cardinal Ottaviani sketched out the moral challenges facing the Church. The Church needed to challenge, quote, the attempt to substitute the useful, the agreeable, the good of the race, the interests of a class, or the power of the state as the criterion of morality. Thus, philosophical systems, literary fashions, and political doctrines have been created and propagated. These try to substitute for the Christian moral order the so-called morality of the situation or individualistic morality, often condemned by Pius XII, and finally condemned by a decree of the Holy Office in February of 1956. These also try to substitute the morality of independence, i.e. divorced from the Christian morality, for the idea of God, sanction, and obligation. Well, that in itself, if the Jews are into what's good for Jews as their moral criterion, but yet the popes are becoming more liberal in ignoring Jew history and just denouncing Nazis. The reference to moralities of race and class referred to Nazism and communism, but they were conjoined in condemnation with the so-called morality of situation or individualistic morality, which could only refer to errors emanating from America. There was risk involved here, since American Catholics were overwhelmingly pious churchgoers at the time, in comparison to their brothers in Europe, and contributed significantly to the Vatican's finances. As the council progressed, the condemnation of the American threat to Catholic morality became more and more overt. To, quote, defend the immutable principles of Christian modesty and chastity, the council warned of the energy spent by the world of fashion, movies, and the press to shake the foundations of Christian morality, as if the Sixth Commandment was outmoded and free rein should be given to all passions, even those against nature. The council was to clarify and eventually condemn attempts to revive paganism and the abuse of psychoanalysis to justify even things directly contrary to the moral order. In May 1962, Ottaviani issued The Esteem of Virginity and Chastity, which he said reflects the most acute and discussed moral problems of our day. As Italian director Federico Fellini was saying in films like La Dolce Vita, American films as the vehicle for American mores were undermining the traditional way of life in Catholic Europe. James Michener says the same thing about the Spanish Catholics in Iberia, and in Italy in particular. If the church lost its hold on sexual morals, it would lose control of, quote, the ordinary way of sanctification for the majority of the human race. Far from baptizing modernity, the preparatory documents condemned it as one long drawn-out occasion of sin. Quote, modern life, without doubt, multiplies invitations to evil by such distractions as beauty contests, spectacles, billboards, songs, illustrated magazines, beaches, places of vacation, promiscuity, and certain forms of sport. This is why the church never ceases to recall to each one the principles of prudence, conscience, and responsibility, the rights and duties of liberty, and the obligation of vigilance and precaution on the part of parents, educators, and civil authorities. This is also why the church points out as dangerous and condemns as erroneous all theories that are then translated into practice concerning the cult of movie stars, naturalism, the so-called sexual education, pansexualism, and certain injurious aspects of psychoanalysis. It didn't take a genius to know who in America was prominent in supporting the cult of movie stars, pansexualism, and psychoanalysis. It was the Jews. So the council became a battleground over whose interpretation of the Jews was going to be normative. Were the Jews the, quote, people of the Old Testament, as Jules Isaac portrayed them? Or were they, in practice, the avant-garde of modernity and the promoters of sexual deviance as a covert form of control, as Ottaviani implicitly portrayed them? The American hierarchy was plagued with its own Jewish problem ever since they began censoring Hollywood in 1934 with the creation of the Production Code and the Legion of Decency. Psychoanalysis had come in for condemnation at the hands of the famous TV priest Fulton J. Sheen. In March 1947, Sheen gave a sermon on, quote, psychoanalysis and confession in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. In it, Sheen derided Freudianism as philosophy, a philosophy based on materialism, hedonism, infantilism, and eroticism. In the February-March 1947 issue of McCall's, Claire Booth Luce told of her conversion to Catholicism. Luce had undergone psychoanalysis by a Jewish psychiatrist shortly after divorcing her first husband. After exposure to confession, Luce resented her treatment at the hands of Jews. Quote, we Christian innocents, she wrote, have been duped into our present godless condition by the unholy triumvirate of communism, psychoanalysis, and relativity. These three, symbolized by Marx, Freud, and Einstein, are the result of the messianic impulse of the religiously frustrated Jewish ego. It didn't take long for the Jews to react to this shot across their bow. Both Sheen and Luce were accused of anti-Semitism in 1948 in the American Scholar because they, quote, leave the careful reader an impression that responsibility for our present spiritual inadequacy rests not only on Freud, but as well on the other outstanding thinkers of Jewish origin. Time, run by Mrs. Luce's husband, Henry Luce, that is, tried to patch things up by contrasting Sheen with Father Coughlin, but the cultural battle lines have been drawn. As in the Hollywood obscenity battle of the 30s, the Jews were on one side and the Catholics on the other. By the time the Vatican Council convened, the American bishops were showing signs of battle fatigue in their culture war with the Jews, and the council looked like a way of declaring a separate peace, or like a battle between Americans who wanted an accommodation with the Jews versus traditionalists like Ottaviani, who, say, saw Hollywood Jews, Reichian pansexualists, and Freudian psychiatrists as the main threat to Catholic morals in a Europe weakened by two catastrophic wars. Given Jewish dominance in the media, it was easy to see who was going to be portrayed as the villain in this scenario. If someone had pointed out that the preparatory reports had used Hollywood, pansexualism, and psychoanalysis as code words for Jewish subversion of morals, it would have exposed the ethnic dimensions of a struggle generally perceived as an intra-Catholic, struggle between liberals and conservatives. So no one portrayed it in those terms, not in the major media anyway. As in most ethnic battles, political surrogates replaced the real players. The Vatican Council was portrayed as a battle between the forces of darkness and reaction, symbolized by Cardinal Ottaviani, and the forces of light and progress, symbolized in American journals by the Jesuit John Courtney Murray, who appeared on the, which is not John Murray Cudahy, though it sounds familiar, who appeared on the cover of Time when contestation over the council began. If there was one man responsible for this Manichaean scenario, it was Robert Blair Kaiser. If there was one organ responsible for the dissemination of those views, it was Time magazine. Kaiser entered the Jesuits in the late 40s and was out by the mid-50s, convinced by modernism and the evolutionary thought of Teilhard de Chardin that he could better achieve the goals of the Jesuits by leaving the order. Given what became of the Jesuits, this was at least an arguable proposition, but not as Kaiser wanted to argue it. He soon became a bachelor reporter in California, driving from one sexual encounter to another in his 56 Thunderbird. Then he married and landed a job at Time. When the Second Vatican Council opened in October 1962, Kaiser was there to cover it. Kaiser takes credit for converting Time to the global vision he learned as a young Jesuit scholastic by reading Chardin and Cardinal Suhard. Quote, "By making information available to an international community of men and women who had an uncommon say in running the planet, Time was contributing to a better world by opening up channels of communication that had long been clogged. That was a worthy cause. Kaiser's reporting bespoke a meeting of the minds, mostly of Jesuits, who had committed themselves to church reform through the media. Kaiser was so zealous in coming down in favor of the liberals that he was reprimanded by his bureau chief, who sketched Time's editorial policy in a memo to Kaiser. Quote, "We have clearly opted in print for the reformation of the Catholic Church undertaken by Pope John, and now presumably being carried forward by Pope Paul. My caution is this, we should not make our stories and our reporting so one-sided that we become naked partisans in this rather than skeptical spectators." Time's reformation of the Catholic Church involved leveraging the Pope's genial personality into sympathy for everything the modern world hated about the Catholic Church. So Kaiser portrayed the Pope as a secret modernist all along, and then, when he became Pope, an open one. The one area in which the Church was most glaringly out of sync with the modern world was its attitude toward the Jews. To remedy that, John XXIII, according to Kaiser, asked Cardinal Bea to prepare a schema for the council that would revise the old Catholic story about the Jews killing Christ and thus bringing eternal damnation on them and on their children, too. It was a myth that had nurtured anti-Semitism for decades, for centuries. One of the tenets of Ron Calley's modernism, according to Kaiser, was the belief that Jews did not need to convert in order to be saved. Kaiser related an anecdote he got from Monsignor Loris Capovilla, the Pope's personal secretary. When a young Jew came to Ron Calley and asked to become a Catholic, the future Pope put him off, saying, "Be a good Jew, because becoming a Catholic would kill your parents." Ron Calley eventually relented and had the man baptized in secret. After Ron Calley became Pope, and the man asked the Pope to confirm him, the Pope allegedly replied, all right, but you've got to continue being a good Jew in your own synagogue, support the Jewish shul, because by being a Catholic, you do not become any less a Jew." If true, the anecdote reveals a fatal ambiguity at the heart of the Jewish question as discussed at Vatican Council II. So what you see here is that even the Pope is a racialist. Jones's position, frankly, isn't tenable. And I increasingly believe, that he realizes this and may have even intended under a universalist cover, very Jewy, right? Catholicism being the universal cover, he is actually promoting a specific racial group's interest, and that would be whites. Something to think about. The question was simple. fatal ambiguity at the heart of the Jewish question, as discussed at Vatican II. The question was simple. Did a Jew remain a Jew after he was baptized? The traditional Catholic answer was no. The Jew, a rejecter of Christ, ceased being a rejecter of Christ upon baptism. Jews should be admitted to the church, quote, without prejudice, unquote, because through baptism they ceased being Jews. If, on the other hand, becoming a Catholic meant, quote, you do not become any less a Jew, then Jewish identity was bound up with blood, race, and DNA, the very view which Christ rejected in the Gospel of St. John. How about that? At this point, it wasn't clear which view the church was going to espouse in its schema on the Jews. And we're on page 89 now, heading for 896. In August 1962, Cardinal Bea granted an interview to the Jewish Chronicle, in which he stated unequivocally that the church intended to use the council to issue an official and radical condemnation of anti-Semitism. After the first session of the council, Bea used the hiatus before the second session to consult with Jewish groups. The major Jewish organizations used the opportunity to lobby for concessions from the church. Rabbi Abraham J. Heschel, who met Bea when both were students in Berlin 30 years earlier, collaborated with the American Jewish Committee, which had issued, quote, The Image of the Jews in Catholic Teaching, which Bea had read in preparation for dialogue with the Jews, which began in earnest in January 1963. Heschel wanted the Vatican to ban what he termed proselytizing, which meant a revocation of the belief that Jews had to accept Christ as their Savior to enter the Kingdom of Heaven. He also wanted the Council to ban any reference to the Jews as an accursed race. The cursed race claim was a Jewish extrapolation from Matthew 27:26, in which the Jewish people, quote, to a man, shouted back to Pontius Pilate after he offered to release Jesus, His blood be on us and on our children. The real issue, the issue the Jews did not want to face, was the Jewish rejection of Christ, which was ongoing, not by occult force, but because of Jewish will. By portraying this rejection as a curse, the Jews trivialized it and placed the onus not on their rejection of Christ, but on the church as the perpetrator of some occult voodoo spell, which, while harmless of itself, had caused prejudice which led to persecution, culminating in the Holocaust. B'nai-B'rith wanted the church to delete any language it deemed anti-Semitic from the Catholic liturgy. This was a tall order because the liturgy was based on the scripture that was, if not anti-Semitic, then certainly anti-Jewish. Virtually the entire Gospel of St. John and the Acts of the Apostles revolved around the conflict between the Jews who accepted Christ as their Savior and the Jews who rejected him. Since those texts were central to any Catholic liturgy and full of invidious comparisons between the new Israel, the Catholic Church, and the old, repudiated by Christ for blindness and obstinacy, it was hard to see how dialogue could succeed. Unless, of course, the purpose of dialogue was something other than what it claimed to be.
Those who came to oppose the schema on the Jews claim that ulterior motives had been driving the discussion from the beginning. Their fears were confirmed 3 years after the fact. In March 1963, when a limousine picked Cardinal Bea up at the Plaza Hotel in New York and deposited him at the offices of the American Jewish Committee 6 blocks away. When Bea arrived, a Latter-day Sanhedrin was waiting to greet him. The meeting, of course, was kept secret from the press. It was also kept secret from the Vatican Council Fathers. I am not authorized to speak officially, Bea told the Jews. I can, therefore, speak only of what, in my opinion, could be affected, indeed should be affected, by the council. The Jews, Bea continued, were accused of deicide, and on them is supposed to lie a curse. According to the only account of the meeting, Bea repudiated both charges. Quote, because even in the accounts of the evangelist, only the leaders of the Jews then in Jerusalem and a very small group of followers shouted for the death sentence on Jesus. All those absent and the generations of Jews unborn were not implicated in deicide in any way, Baez said. As to the curse, it could not condemn the crucifiers, the cardinal reasoned, because Christ's dying words were a prayer for their pardon. Baez concluded it was by claiming it was wrong to seek the chief cause of anti-Semitism in purely religious sources, in the gospel accounts, for example. These religious causes, insofar as they are adduced, often they are not, are often merely an excuse and a veil to cover over other more operative reasons for enmity. Baez did not identify the more operative reasons for enmity, or if he did, his explanation went unreported. As a result of the meeting, the Jewish organizations assigned two lobbyists to monitor the progress of the Jewish schema at the council, Joseph Lichten of B'nai B'rith's Anti-Defamation League and Zechariah Schuster of the American Jewish Committee. Both men had lost relatives to the Nazis during World War II. Both were determined to bring the strongest possible Jewish declaration back from Rome so their respective organizations could claim credit for it. In addition to lobbying the church fathers in Rome, the Jews sought to change the climate of public opinion by other means. In February 1963, Rolf Hochhuth's play Der Stellvertreter, The Deputy, opened in Berlin. Hochhuth portrayed Pope Pius XII as criminally negligent because of his silence on the deportation of the Jews during World War II. After it opened in London, Giovanni Battista Mantini, Archbishop of Milan and soon to be Pope Paul VI, attacked it as a defamation of Pius XII, whose secretary he had been. The Pope was probably aware that Erwin Piscator, a Jewish communist, along with the already mentioned Jewish organizations, AJC and ADL, provided financial backing for the play. Monsignor John Osterreicher, the Jewish convert responsible for the Jewish schema under Baer, accused the AJC and the ADL of poisoning the waters by promoting the play. Quote, Jewish human relations agencies, he wrote in America, will have to speak out against the deputy in unmistakable terms, otherwise they will defeat their own purpose. The press ignored Osterreicher's warning, playing up Hochhuth's accusations instead. Hochhuth's message was clear. If the incoming pope, John XXIII, was dying, who would succeed him was unknown, didn't want to go down in history as another Pius XII, guilty because silent, he better pass the schema on the Jews. As Osterreicher warned, the Jewish media campaign caused a reaction. Amleto Cardinal Ciccone, a powerful conservative in the Curia and former delegate to the United States, expressed fear that issuing a statement on the Jews might not be in the Church's best interest. Baez countered that he had already assured the Jews that a statement was forthcoming, so failure to produce one would be construed as mendacity. As resistance grew among the conservatives, Baez kept claiming he had created a growing tide of expectation in the Jewish circles and in the pluralistic societies of America and Germany, and that now he had to meet that expectation. The Jewish lobby was not going to take no for an answer. Hochhuth's play did not begin the campaign against Pius XII. In France, François Mauriac had attacked him in 1951, for which he received a Nobel Prize. Mauriac would later be instrumental in cleaning up Elie Wiesel's violently anti-Christian Yiddish memoir, Und die Welt hat geschwiegen, and the world was silent, and turning it into La Nuit, The Night, which earned Wiesel a Nobel Prize as well. In 1958, the Jewish communist François Kuste Drahoki elaborated on Mauriac's charges. Why, she asked, call Pius XII the Pope of Peace rather than of War? He no more stopped the latter than he imposed the former. Pius XII's pontificate was totally bankrupt. War, torture, the annihilation of the individual, and cruelty in all its forms reached a level never before attained. It's a shame that Pius XII never got around to excommunicating Nazis with the same level of indignation that he had for excommunicating communists. If he was not aware of what was going on in Germany, then all the Vatican's listening posts are useless. If he was aware... .. In June 1963, Pope John XXIII died, and Montini, who had already attacked the deputy in his defense of Pius XII, was elected as his successor, taking the name Paul VI. Paul VI was aware of the expectations Béa had aroused, but he was also aware of growing conservative resentment, especially over the slander of Pius XII, and equally aware that he had to reconcile increasingly hostile camps. The second session of the council opened on September 20, 1963. Its main concern was the Schema de Ecclesiae. Hearing the schema on the Jews had been incorporated into a larger document on ecumenism, the Israeli ambassador to Italy, Maurice Fischer, called on Pope Paul VI to find out whether the document dealt with the Jewish question. Sensing he must do something to ease the disappointment of the Jews, Paul VI and his advisors came up with the idea of visiting Israel during a trip he was planning to the Middle East. In recognizing the existence of the Jewish state, Paul VI hoped the disappointment would be lessened. The Jewish lobby, however, was not going to take no for an answer, and resistance to the document was growing among the bishops for precisely that reason. The trip to the Holy Land suggested that the tensions had become more than mere mortals could resolve. From the Jewish perspective, the second session, which ended on December 4, 1963, was a distinct disappointment. The media barrage, however, continued unabated. Schuster and Lichten were experts at getting their views into the New York Times. Fritz Becker, lobbyist for the World Jewish Congress, specialized in quiet diplomacy. "We don't have the American outlook," he said, referring to Lichten and Schuster, "on the importance of getting into print." The deputy opened in Paris on December 9th. 4 days later, it opened in Basel in Switzerland. The Jewish lobby kept up the pressure with three more openings. In Vienna on January 22, 1964, in New York on February 28, and in Tel Aviv on June 20. Outraged that the second session ended without a passage of the Jewish schema, the Jewish lobby demanded that the American cardinals pressure the pontiff for a declaration on the Jews, but at no stage did a delegation of American cardinals go to him and insist on the discussion of religious liberty in the Jewish document. By this point, the Jewish lobbying was beginning to cause a reaction. Pamphlets on the Jews began to appear at the councils. The Jews in the Council in the Light of the Holy Scripture by Bernardus offered the most rational presentation from the official church standpoint. Its message? Scripture states clearly that the Jews were voluntary deicides. The fathers of the church supported this doctrine. St. Thomas Aquinas wrote that the attitude of the Roman pontiffs can only be interpreted as an affirmation that the Jews partake of a worldwide plot to destroy the church. Hence, all should be wary of the Jew and not destroy a fundamental dogma of the church. The tract of Bernardus, which was followed by a Complotto contra la Chiesa, 4,000 copies of which were distributed to the Council Fathers. Fortified with a heavy-duty expense account by time, Robert Blair Kaiser turned his spacious Roman apartment into a gathering place for conciliar progressives, those who were pushing hardest for updating everything, and doing so with a high hilarity. In addition to regular Sunday night soirees of progressives, Kaiser held intimate dinner parties where church leaders could talk about their hopes with people they would otherwise never meet. Bishop Mendez of Cuernavaca in Mexico, for example, found himself opposite the Hollywood director Otto Preminger over dinner one evening. Joining them were Kaiser and Gregoire Le Mercier, prior of the Benedictine monastery in Cuernavaca, who explained to Kaiser's dinner guests how he had profited from psychoanalysis. He explained to Preminger how Freudian psychoanalysis had transformed his monks into better Benedictines. Preminger, who, like Cardinal Ottaviani and Bishop Sheen, felt that Catholicism and Freudianism were like oil and water, asked Le Mercier where he had found a Catholic psychiatrist. It turns out that Le Mercier couldn't find a Catholic psychiatrist, and so he brought in one who was an atheist and a Jew instead. That psychiatrist brought along a woman assistant who convinced many of the monks that the only reason they had joined the monastery was their fear of sexuality. Once they understood that, many of the monks then abandoned the order. Le Mercier's claim that Freudian psychoanalysis had strengthened the monastery left Preminger shaking his head in wonder. At this point, Kaiser turned to Bishop Mendez and asked his opinion on the abbot's use of Freud to empty out of the monasteries under his jurisdiction. "With Gregorio's help," Mendez replied, "I am preparing an intervention for the council. I think it's time we baptized Freud. One wonders how Cardinal Ottaviani would have replied to the Kaiser's question, but Ottaviani was not invited to his apartment. One council father who showed up regularly was the Irish Jesuit Malachi Martin. Martin, like Bea, was connected to the Biblicum, the Jesuit-run university for scripture scholars in Rome. Like Bea, he was working behind the scenes on the Jewish schema. Kaiser felt Martin was, quote, one of the good guys who, quote, cut a fine figure of a priest in his tailored suit. Martin, Kaiser heard, had been sent to Rome to save the Biblicum from the conservatives who wanted to shut it down. The admiration was mutual, or so it seemed. After one Sunday evening, Martin whispered conspiratorially in Kaiser's ear how important these Sunday nights had become to the progress of the council. Every cleric I've met is talking about these parties. They're saying this is where ideas are incubated, friendships struck, new national alliances formed, strategies laid, plans formed for each coming week. Kaiser appreciated the flattery because he believed that he had been sent to Rome to influence the events he was supposedly reporting on. Martin's access to key personae made him a valuable source of inside information. It also allowed Kaiser to feel he was influencing the outcome of the council. Before long, Kaiser would come to doubt both propositions. This is Times guy who's in Rome, and he's hosting these gatherings, and they're trying to update the church, that is, make it in alignment with modern liberalism, which, if the church doesn't oppose and offer an alternative to it, really doesn't have much reason to exist. But now, Malachi Martin would later go on to flip, or he was playing both sides all along, or he was never the liberal he appeared to be, but always an undercover conservative. It's hard to say. Before long, Kaiser would come to doubt both propositions. The first to go was his reliance on Martin. Martin was forever feeding him inside information, but when Kaiser's reporting was challenged, Martin couldn't or wouldn't back it up. Other people were learning the same lesson. After Father Gus Weigel was quoted in the New York Times saying the Jewish schema was in trouble, he was reprimanded by Cardinal Bay for spreading lies and blacklisted. Kaiser knew Martin was Weigel's source. Martin had tried to peddle the story for time. Martin maintained the story was true in spite of denials of the Willebrands and Bea, much to Weigel's perplexity, since he lost his credibility due to Martin's false report. Kaiser by this time had stopped using Martin as a source, but he was still unable to figure out the agenda behind his actions. As Bea's assistant, Martin's main concern was the Jewish schema. Martin supplied Kaiser with a steady diet of stories to show he was thwarting reactionaries in the Curia who allied with prelates from the Arab nations to sabotage Catholic-Jewish relations by scuttling the schema on the Jews. To do this, they were not above sending phony telegrams from Bea's office to the AJC in New York, or forged letters on Bea's stationery to the Council Central Commission. Flipping on to 894. After the Weigel incident, Kaiser was convinced that Martin was circulating false stories about the Jewish schema, in quotes. Once burned by using Martin's information in stories he had filed for Time, Kaiser soon began to feel that Martin was manipulating him for his own ends. What those ends were became apparent one Sunday evening when Martin showed up at Kaiser's apartment, quote, with a pair of important American Jews, representatives of the AJC, in tow. Suddenly, Martin's reason for circulating the stories that had ruined Weigel's reputation became clear. Martin, Kaiser now realized, was their lobbyist. These Jews were using him and paying him well for his help, which they thought they needed because they were reading those stories in the New York Times. Martin had planted the stories to give the Jews the impression his efforts were indispensable in saving a document that wasn't in trouble. The Jews had been taken in by Martin's ruse, and they rewarded him handsomely for his duplicity. During the summer between the second and third session, Kaiser noted that Malachi had always had a wallet stuffed with $100 bills. Now Kaiser knew where he was getting them. Kaiser told his wife, but he was taken back by her response. "What's the matter with that?" she asked. "Well," Kaiser stammered. If he's a paid lobbyist, at least he ought to register so people know where he's coming from. Regaining his composure, Kaiser went on the offensive. Have you ever wondered why he's always with Zachariah Schuster? He used to get spending money from me. He doesn't get it from me anymore. I think he's getting it from the American Jewish Committee. I think he's keeping the pot boiling just to make himself more indispensable to the Jews. Kaiser found his wife's response unsettling. Martin had given Mary Kaiser a copy of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, underlining portions denigrating husbands and writing comments in the margins. Seeing Friedan's book as a seduction device, Kaiser suspected that Martin had designs on his wife. Michael Novak, another American correspondent at the council, aggravated Kaiser's fear by claiming Martin and Mary were having an affair. During one of his wife's increasingly frequent absences, Kaiser, consumed with suspicion, discovered birth control pills while rooting through his wife's lingerie. Kaiser had been researching a birth control story he hoped would overturn the church teaching. In his misguided way, Kaiser thought his, quote, reporting might help overturn the tyranny of an authority with a very limited view of marriage, one that I believed was having a damaging effect on millions of Catholic marriages. Instead, it looked as if he had facilitated his wife's adultery. The pill, however, wasn't the only facilitator that Kaiser had to worry about. It turned out that Jewish activists, in exchange for Martin's contribution toward a Jewish schema favorable to their interests, were willing to facilitate the Irish Jesuit's adultery with Mary Kaiser. While hoping for a reconciliation with his wife, Kaiser noted that instead of coming to the hotel where he had arranged to meet her in Paris, his wife, quote, stopped off to see Zachariah Schuster and two other friends of Malachi Martin's in the Paris offices of the American Jewish Committee. The AJC had agreed to, or led Mary to believe, give her a job when she ran off with Malachi Martin. Mary, Kaiser writes at another point, planned a European rendezvous with Malachi in Paris, where she thought she would be given a job at the American Jewish Committee. Zachariah Schuster was not only paying Martin to subvert the Jewish schema, he was also helping him to commit adultery. Blinded by his commitment to views he considered progressive, Kaiser failed to see that the council was providing an opening for all of the church's traditional enemies. At around the same time that Kaiser's wife began taking birth control pills to conceal any possible effects of her affairs with Malachi Martin, Kaiser discovered the church was thinking of changing its teaching on birth control. Predictably, he considered it a good thing, quote, if frozen Catholic attitudes on birth control would start melting under the great reforming heat of this council, because, quote, then the council would start meaning more to American Catholics in the same way that it was having more meaning for Kaiser's wife. Kaiser also came into possession of a memo written by Planned Parenthood Federation of America chairman Donald B. Strauss describing his visit to Rome in February 1963. Strauss met with Monsignor Cardinale, who told him that the church had no quarrel with Planned Parenthood over its goals, only wanted its assurance that the organization was not pushing all kinds of contraceptives without regard for moral considerations. Strauss was taken aback by the liberal views expressed by Monsignor Cardinale and wondered if the word could not be passed along that discussion with Planned Parenthood representatives did not amount to consorting with the devil. 2 years later, in the summer of 1965, Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, CSC, president of the University of Notre Dame, arranged a meeting between John D. Rockefeller III and Pope Paul VI, during which Mr. Rockefeller offered to write the Pope's birth control encyclical for him. This, quote, openness to the modern world also led to the Commission on Birth Control, which Paul VI rejected when he issued Humanae Vitae in 1968. Kaiser soon discovered that Martin was writing his own book in the council under the pseudonym of Michael Serafian. Kaiser was taken aback by the news, but hardly in a position to object much, since much of his own book in the council had been written by Martin as well. Martin would later become a prolific author of books of dubious accuracy. His book of the Jesuits purportedly was based on inside sources, but was riddled with obvious factual errors. By the end of his career, Martin confined himself to Romans a Clef, like Windswept House, a purported expose of corruption in the church from a conservative viewpoint. During the Vatican Council, Roger Strauss, quote, one of the most distinguished guys in the New York publishing world, took on Martin as an author and established publishing connections for Martin that lasted for the rest of his life. No matter how savagely his books were panned, Martin never lost access to big-name publishing houses. When Jack Shea showed Kaiser the manuscript of Martin's The Pilgrim, Kaiser turned quickly to a passage concerning the schema on the Jews and concluded, "It's Malachi, all right, and it looks like it's a fabrication." From the Jewish perspective, however, The Pilgrim was far from a fabrication. It was a faithful rendition of the Jewish indictment of the Catholic Church launched by Jules Isaac. From the tolerance of an Innocent III to the attitude of most Catholics toward Jews today, Martin wrote, there's a direct line of affiliation. Between the burning and plundering of all Jewish synagogues in Mesopotamia in 388 AD on the order of the Bishop of Callinicum, and the destruction or desecration of all synagogues under the recent Nazi regime, we cannot but see a relationship of origin. Martin continued, quote, no one conscious of what has made modern Europe can deny the pyres and the crematoria, the mephitic smoke and stench of the extermination camps in Nazi Germany. Today they don't even claim there were any in Germany. But they did at one point. At this point, were, if not the logical conclusion, at least one extremist consequence of the normal Christian attitude to the Jews. So even if you have a policy of Sikko Judaeus known, they're going to lie and claim you want to exterminate them. No matter what you do, you're a Nazi if you're not a Jew. In June 1964, the New York Times reported that the denial of Jewish responsibility for deicide had been cut from the latest draft of the schema. Bea's office quickly denied the charge. The source of the rumor was most likely Malachi Martin. The Jews, however, were upset. Richard Cardinal Cushing of Boston arranged a personal meeting between Rabbi Heschel and Pope Paul VI. Heschel, not Herschel, but Heschel, who attended the meeting with Zachariah Schuster, wanted the Pope and the Council to ban proselytizing Jews. They don't want Jews trying to convert them. Sensing in mid-interview that Heschel's chutzpah offended the Pope, Schuster switched to French, freezing Heschel out of the conversation. The conservatives on the council were even more offended by Jewish effrontery. The AJC tried to distance itself from Heschel's remarks, but the conservatives used the incident to discredit their opponents, especially the American bishops, who were seen as Jewish lackeys. As if to prove the conservatives right, Cushing demanded that the deicide denial be put back in the document, and Bishop Stephen Levin of San Antonio called for a ban on converting Jews. He turns their denial against them. You're a deicide denialist. In the end, the heavy-handed Jewish lobbying tactics backfired. Heschel maintained that his chutzpah did some good, but the consensus began to emerge that Jewish effrontery had harmed the Jewish cause. Even a devoted supporter of the Jews, like Cardinal Cushing, was forced to conclude that, quote, the only people who could beat the Jewish declaration were the Jewish lobbyists. And that ends that chapter, so we see the church begin to give way to the Jews, their lobbying, rather than stand up to them. And that will do it for chapter 24, and thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again with more. Real soon.